right now on the Daily Debrief. A verdict in the case of a Florida law professor murdered in his car. Plus,
and he starts shooting and shooting and shooting and shooting and shooting.
Opening statements in the case of a pregnant ex-girlfriend shot and killed. Is it murder or self-defense?
I have my hands up like this.
Also, the penalty phase of the case of the so-called Hollywood Ripper, who prosecutors say attacked 11 women.
Oh God, we both have an eye.
And a doctor beaten to death with a hammer. Testimony against one of three defendants enters a second day. The Daily Debrief brings you the day in court. It's Friday, October 11th.
Welcome to the Debrief, everybody. Let's begin with opening statements in the Florida prosecution of a man accused of murdering his pregnant ex-girlfriend. Markeith Lloyd is accused of killing 24-year-old Sade Dixon. The medical examiner says she was shot 8 times. Lloyd also shot and injured Dixon's brother, Ronald Stewart. After a massive manhunt, Lloyd is accused of shooting and killing a police officer, but many of the details of that second shooting are not allowed in this trial. He says the shootings were self-defense. With me today are attorney Spencer Cordell from Fort Myers, Florida, Eklund Mercy from Atlanta, Georgia, and Michael Bryant here in New York. Let's listen to how the state explained its theory of these shootings.
The defendant, who had moved to the end of the driveway, then came up and stood just off of the concrete walkway in the yard. He reached into the hand warmer part of his jacket, fumbled, pulled out a Smith & Wesson 40 caliber semi-automatic pistol that he had brought with him. He said, "Nah, she ain't going away. She's not going with you." She cocked the gun, he pointed it, and he fired. The first round hit Ronald Stewart in the abdomen, and he fell to the ground there on the porch between the pillar and the house. The defendant then approached the porch, firing. He hit Sade Dixon several times. She fell down. He came up onto the porch, turned. Ronald Stewart was laying on his back. He walked over, stood over Ronald, shot him a couple more times, left, and walked out to his car.
Lloyd fled and led police on a weeks-long manhunt. A woman recognized Lloyd in a Walmart and told Orlando Police Sergeant Deborah Clayton that Lloyd was there. The police officer who happened to be inside confronted Lloyd.
The defendant broke to the left and ran around a pillar that was standing there. He came out on the other side with a firearm. There was an exchange of gunfire between him and Sergeant Clayton. After the gunfire, the defendant ran across the parking lot, got in his car, and drove away. A little over a week later, police located the defendant in a house on Westcott Lane. After surrounding the house, told him to come out. Opened the front door and he threw something out. Then he came out and crawled away from the house. Police officers moved in and they found the item that had been thrown out. It was a 40 caliber Smith & Wesson semi-automatic handgun. That gun was sent to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement Crime Lab, where it was examined and compared to the 11 shell casings found in front of 6031 Long Peak Drive. They determined they all had been fired from that gun. The 8 shell casings that had been found in front of the Walmart in the lab determined that that firearm fired all 8.
Lloyd's defense has a different version of what happened. They say Lloyd went over to the victim's house to try to mend things, but that the victim escalated the situation.
And she's accusing him. And she's accusing him. And she's accusing him of being unfaithful. And Marquis's only concern at this point, he wants to defuse the situation at first. He wants not to be an issue with this child. And so at some point he realizes he's got to be honest. Because in his mind, he's no longer in a relationship with her, even though it's a few days or whatever. So he tells her, "You're right. I had sex with my ex-girlfriend." And she says, "Wait here." What's going through her mind? Anger, helplessness. So she does something really, really stupid. Up the stairs to her room where there's a box. She opens the locked box and takes a gun. And when he sees the gun, he pulls his two guns out. He had one back here, I believe, one under his arm. He pulls the two guns out, and he's pointing at her. And he's saying, what? You're going to shoot me? Are you going to shoot me? Are you kidding? Drop the gun. Drop the gun. And instead of pointing it at him, she pulls it out and goes like this and then drops it. And he squeezes the trigger. Because he believes when she's doing that at that moment, she's going to kill him.
The defense says Sade Dixon's gun did not fire, so Dixon dropped it and ran. Her older brother, Ron, then entered the situation. Lloyd apparently told Ron that the victim had been cheating on him. That's when Lloyd's defense says things got really heated.
And you will hear that her response was to him, why don't you tell him about the guns you just held to my head? So now the brother knows he's armed and has not one weapon, but two weapons in his possession. And so the brother again is trying to defuse the situation. And so she turned up the flames one more level on her brother when she says, my brother can whip your. And to make matters worse, Ron's in a situation where he sees this going out of control. He goes after Marquise. He tries to take him. And there is a struggle. He has the gun. And they are struggling. And they are struggling across the front yard. And at some point, the gun discharges and hits the brother. Marquise doesn't know exactly where Sade is. He knows that he lost the gun, and he starts shooting and shooting and shooting and shooting and shooting.
That's a lot of shooting. A neighbor testified about hearing all this commotion.
We heard gunshots.
Do you remember how many gunshots you heard?
I believe it's four.
Okay. Did you hear anything else after you heard the gunshots?
I didn't hear nothing else until I opened the door. From my door, I heard Sade's mother screaming, and I seen two bodies on the ground. Oh my God, I shot my baby, shot my baby. And she kept screaming. Then she was screaming a name out, his name. And she said, he shot my baby. He shot my child or something like that. And then I just got the phone and started calling 911.
The surviving victim, Ronald Stewart, took the stand for the state. He says he heard his sister banging on the door trying to come inside their house. That's when he says he walked outside and saw the defendant pull out a gun.
He did his motion to, put the bullet in a chamber. Mm-hmm. And held it up. And before he did that, I was like, it's not that serious, bro. And I had my hands up like this.
Okay. And what happened?
I heard a bang. And next thing I know, I didn't have control over my body. And it felt like someone kicked me really, really, really hard in my stomach. And I fell down uncontrollably. He kept on shooting. And he stepped over me, kept on shooting her. I guess he stopped shooting her, put his intention on me, and he held the gun towards me and started shooting upwards. He hit me twice in the leg, two bullets in the leg, and he was aiming for my heart. I rotated my side to cover my heart so he won't hit it. As that last shot hit, still hit me in my chest, I heard the door open and then I heard it slam.
Everybody's here to chime in on this case. Attorney Spencer Cordell, you're local to this case. What can you tell us from your perspective?
Well, it's a dramatic case, obviously. Very heartfelt testimony that came out today. That's going to really hit the jury hard. The defense is cross-examining, making small points here and there with that. But that compelling testimony from family members who are eyewitnesses is going to be very hard for the defense to overcome.
That was my thought exactly. If I were sitting here trying to figure out who to believe, I would have to believe the surviving victim, Michael Bryant. Now, granted, the defense could say he's sticking up for his sister, but I found him credible.
Yeah, I mean, he really was. And if you take a step back to the defense opening, which was very, very well done, great story that was told. But then you hear the witness tell his version of the story, and it's a little different. But the defense did make some points by showing some contradiction between the deposition from that young man in March and his testimony today. So just a little bit of movement toward the defense on that point.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, the core narrative seems to win the day in court. Eklund Mercy, does the defense get to tell that kind of a story in openings and then not put the defendant on the stand?
No, well, I don't know. The issue is you have a volatile defendant. So you don't know what Marquise is going to do. You've seen his outbursts in court. You've seen his requests, you know, so you don't know what this defendant's going to do. Hopefully, like when you're having trials like this and when you have a trial, you know, they did make a motion, you know, to have a mental evaluation. He was found competent. When you have a defendant like that, you don't know what's going to happen. You play every hour on the hour. You hope that he doesn't do anything crazy. For me, particularly, he did good, you know, as a defense attorney. Like when the mom was testifying, you have to keep looking at Marquise. Hopefully he doesn't do anything to mess it up. So the defense here is doing a great job of keeping, you know, his witness under control. I mean, keeping his client under the control, but also putting a wedge in there, like making little holes of reasonable doubt. And hopefully, you know, to him, hopefully he could make it make sense during his closing.
Exactly. Okay, Spencer, one last question here. Is it self-defense when you pump that many bullets out of your gun? Because this just wasn't one or two shots. This was a lot of shots.
You can always make the argument, and that's what he's going to do, and obviously do it dramatically. It's going to be a hard sell with the jury. Maybe they can present some testimony that, oh, in the emotion and excitement of the instant, he just kept pulling the trigger. You don't know you're safe until that chamber gets emptied. But the more bullets, the harder a sell is going to be with the jury.
Exactly. Let's move to our next case now. Testimony rolling along this week in the case of the so-called Hollywood Ripper. Michael Gargiulo stands convicted of killing two California women and trying to kill a third by attacking her in her own home. Prosecutors say his crime spree involves 11 total victims, some in other states. The question now is whether he will die a natural death in prison or be put to death by the state. Gargiulo's son pleaded with the jury to let the defendant live. Irving and Maria Bruno had four children together. On the stand, he describes having to tell the children that their mother was dead.
It's been extremely tough throughout the years. I wouldn't want anybody to go through what I went through. The images that I had to see, I can not unsee them, since they ranged in age from 2 to 5. I felt like there really was no need for me to divulge the specifics of how. How she was killed. The ability to create a life with them, form memories with their mother. All gone in the blink of an eye.
The defense called a psychologist who interviewed Michael Gargiulo several times since he's been in jail. This psychologist talked about Gargiulo's school records and his own family's history of mental illness.
His school records indicated that he was in special education throughout his schooling in Illinois. It began at about age 10 when he was in the fifth grade, and he finished in a continuation school when he was about 18. For emotional disturbance, he basically had behavioral problems, and he was considered to have an oppositional conduct disorder. In terms of aunts and uncles, he, on his father's side, there's a paternal aunt who was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and had been mentally ill for many years. On his mother's side, it was a maternal uncle with the same diagnosis. Among the siblings, the father told me that all of Michael's siblings had been diagnosed with mental illnesses and had been admitted to psychiatric facilities at various times.
The defense can try to present any mitigating factors it wants, and we just watched some of that happen. The jury will decide Gargiulo's fate starting early next week. And still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, the case of a doctor beaten to death with a hammer, plus the case of a murdered law professor. A verdict is in against one of two defendants. We'll break down what happened. An attorney for the wealthy Connecticut man accused of disposing of evidence of his wife's disappearance is asking for her medical records yet again. Attorney Norm Pattis says in court documents that he believes missing wife Jennifer Dulos went to the doctor in early July, almost 2 months after she vanished. Jennifer Dulos' family says it believes she is dead. Her ex-husband Fotis Dulos has said that Jennifer may be alive and may be trying to set him up. Day two of testimony in the case of a Florida doctor beaten to death with a hammer. Dr. Teresa Severs did not show up to work back in 2015. A friend checked in on her at home and discovered her cold, bludgeoned body and the alleged murder weapon nearby. Months later, police charged her husband and two other men with plotting to kill her. Investigators say husband Mark Severs hired his longtime friend from Missouri, Curtis Wright, and Wright's friend, Jimmy Rogers, to kill the wife. Rogers is the one on trial right now. Wright struck a deal with prosecutors and is expected to testify against Rogers. Severs will go on trial after Rogers. A crime scene investigator talked about damage to the victim's home and about DNA found on the murder weapon.
This is the exterior edge of that south garage door, and it shows the both sides of the lock and handles. You can see a lot of damage to the door. The door, both locks were unlocked.
Did you also swab the hammer?
Yes, I did.
And when we talk about swabbing the hammer, what were you doing?
And for this object, I was looking for touch DNA, so I swabbed the handle of the hammer.
And was anyone's DNA, did anyone's DNA come back to those swabs?
Nothing foreign to the victim.
So when you say nothing foreign to the victim, what does that mean? And did the swabs come back to be the DNA of Teresa Severs?
Yes, only Teresa Severs' DNA was found on these swabs.
On cross-examination, Rogers' defense pointed to a lack of motive by this particular defendant on trial right now. There was some $50,000 in cash still in the house.
You, in your testimony to Ms. Ross, you indicated that this home had not been ransacked. The home was messy, but it wasn't ransacked.
It did not appear ransacked.
You collected firearms, cash. There was a lot of the photographs that we saw, bottles of cash. There was cash mounted on the wall. You said there was $50,000 in cash in the safes. Nothing was taken.
In the locked safes, I found firearms and cash, yes.
Okay, the hammer that was introduced, that was processed for DNA and fingerprints?
Yes.
Okay, and nothing was found? No fingerprints, no DNA.
There was no fingerprints noted, and the DNA was only matched to Mrs. Severs.
Our next case now, a verdict in the murder of a Florida law professor. Sigfredo Garcia and Catherine McBonowa are accused of killing law professor Dan Markell. The state says the motive was Markell's divorce and custody battle with his ex-wife Wendy Adelson, and that Garcia and McBonowa were basically hired guns. No one in the ex-wife's family has been charged, including the ex-wife herself. McBonowa blames Garcia. Garcia blames a third defendant named Luis Rivera, who cooperated with the state. The jury asked a lot of questions last night and today about the liability of a principal under Florida law. That's someone who's criminally involved with a murder. Here was the ultimate partial verdict.
State of Florida versus Sigfredo Garcia. We, the jury, find as follows. As to count one, the defendant is guilty of first-degree murder. We, the jury, find as follows. As to count two, the defendant is guilty of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. We, the jury, find as follows. As to count three, the defendant is not guilty.
Garcia now, of course, guilty of murder and conspiracy, but not guilty of soliciting murder. That was the last charge. His case moves to a penalty phase. The jury, however, was deadlocked as to Catherine McBonowa. The judge sent the jury back to deliberate some more, but after about 15 or 20 minutes, the jury was still hung, so the judge declared a mistrial as to that defendant. Our guests are back one last time to discuss this case. Michael Bryant, hung jury on her, but not on him. You sensed that it might go this way.
Yeah, I think she took the stand and did a pretty good job of convincing at least one juror that, hey, I wasn't involved in this. I didn't know enough to be part of this conspiracy. In fact, in some of those phone wiretaps, you heard her say, and Garcia say to her, hey, you don't want to know any more than you already know. So I think that helped draw a line for some jurors from the conspiracy count.
Okay, Spencer Cordell, you're down there in Florida. What's your view of this? Do you think the state really had enough to get her? The jury didn't agree. What do you think?
I think they did have enough to get her if the jury had believed everything they presented and didn't believe her testimony. They've got her. She's the only connection between Garcia and Rivera and the Adelson family. So the culpability looks apparent there. And then they had deposits into her account that make it appear that she was getting paid a lot of money after the murder happened. But she managed to tell a very good story, and it convinced at least some of those jurors to find her not guilty.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she's the connection. She's handling the money. Eklin, how was it not a conviction?
Because I think that they had more evidence on Adelson than on McBanua. Like, they were dating. So I don't know what you think, but if we're dating, money is being transferred to me. So so there was a way to explain that, but they had a lot of they had more evidence on Charlie Adelson than on McBanua.
All sorts of questions we could keep going around with this. Michael Bryant, you know, the bottom line is the jury spoke. The bottom line is the state's probably going to retry her. When I see something like this, Michael, I have to sit and say, you know, the state should have done a stronger job of closing this up during closing arguments, telling the jury, okay, this is the law. This is the law that you ultimately need to apply. Circle it, make it really clear how they're trying to connect her to a murder because she wasn't there when the trigger was pulled.
Yeah, you know, they really needed to reinforce you can't get from A to B without C, and she is C. How do you get to Garcia's guilt without her? And they didn't make that clear, or there were enough jurors, one or more, that said, no, not good enough for me.
Exactly, and we could keep talking about this all we want. We're going to have to wait and see exactly how the state's going to move forward with this. Of course, the state could file to retry these charges. The state could go after lesser charges. It's in the prosecutor's court at this point. Spencer Cordell, Eklin Mercy, Michael Bryant, appreciate all of your insights tonight here on The Debrief. Our live coverage for the week is wrapping up. It's Friday evening. Hope you have a good weekend. Live coverage on the Law and Crime Network resumes at 9 o'clock Monday morning Eastern Time. We'll be back on The Debrief